Hello, welcome to The Rest is History, and my friend Gertie Gabber of Historically Based Podcasts, Dominic Sandbrook, is with me. And Dominic, today we're recording this on the 16th of February, and in 2015, Leslie Gore very sadly died. Are you a fan of Leslie Gore? Do you know her greatest hit?
Remind me, Tom, I'm struggling.
It's My Party. And I'll cry if I want to. Cry if I want to. You would cry too if it happened to you. And you could say that at the moment would be the theme song for the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who has endured a torrid few weeks over what the British press have called Partygate. And perhaps for the benefit of our overseas listeners, you could explain exactly why these parties have been so disastrous.
Well, maybe, Tom, I should wait for Sue Gray's report. But since that's not forthcoming, I should say, in the first sort of months or year or so of the lockdown, it is alleged that in Downing Street, Boris Johnson and his aides held an enormous quantity of parties, gatherings, quizzes, drinks, and so on, which they say were all work-related events. But it appeared to be, they look very like parties, which were breaking the government's own COVID rules. So the image is of a government that was making rules for everybody else, but in which the Prime Minister and his aides were kind of ambushing each other with cakes and
ABBA songs,
cheap Prosecco,
and just behaving in a
shameful manner. That's the sort of claim. They claim this was all work-related and they will be completely exonerated. The tension mounts, Tom.
But Dominic, the effect of it on the Prime Minister's standing and on the performance of the government in the polls has been, really very drastic.
Yeah,
and
as
a historian of British politics, have you ever seen a meltdown quite like it? I mean, it seems to me
unprecedented. Loads of meltdowns.
No, over parties?
Not over parties. But I think what it is to my mind, a disastrous party is a bit like a scandal. So a political scandal. So it becomes disastrous. I mean, we're no strangers to disastrous parties. I imagine anybody listening to this. But a party becomes politically disastrous when it seems to throw into relief flaws or sort of anxieties that were already there.
Right. Okay. So on the back of Partygate, we had a brilliant suggestion by Matt Butcher, for which we're very, very grateful, that we should do the top 10 most disastrous parties in history. Which I thought was an absolutely brilliant idea. So that's what we've done. I put out a tweet asking for you, the listeners, to nominate. We put it out on the Discord, and we've had hundreds and hundreds of nominations.
And we have, and we've whittled them down, haven't we?
We have whittled them down. So all the ones that we've got have been suggested by you, the listeners. Boris has not made the cut.
No. I was sorry that some of his colleagues who are listeners to this podcast didn't write in with nominations of their own to maybe nominate his party.
Yes. That secret party we had in the broom cupboard.
Exactly.
That nobody found out about. Several parties were nominated that we've already had on The Rest is History. So Tom Gorman nominated Prince Yusupov's party at the Moika Palace.
Yeah, Rasputin, the end of Rasputin. Yeah.
That was not a good party for him. Sam the Belgian has nominated Joyce and Proust meeting up, which we mentioned in the 1922 episode. Gavin Barrett, Belshazzar's Feast, which in a way is, that's the archetype of a terrible party, the writing on the wall and all that kind of stuff.
You don't want that to happen at your own party, do you?
No.
But I mean, I wouldn't invite Daniel to my party anyway.
No. Yeah, but the whole thing about that is that, the Medes and the Persians come gate crashing in.
That's true.
I mean, that's,
we're all familiar with the issue of gate crashes.
And then we have had several nominations that have been bubbling under. So Stephen Clark, very much a friend of the show. Josef Cieza, am I pronouncing that right? MEP?
He looks Hungarian to me, Tom. I don't know how
he is Hungarian. You're... He's a committed opponent of gay rights.
Right.
And inevitably, he was arrested during lockdown in Brussels, fleeing a gay sex orgy, climbing down a drainpipe.
Oh, that's so off in the way.
So that's quite fun. Amy Matrafardi, fixture on the Discord. The 2011 White House Correspondents' Dinner, where Obama and Seth Meyers mocked the idea of Trump running for president while he was sitting in the audience.
Well, supposedly that was one of the motivating factors.
Yes.
Trump's determination to kind of get his own back. Absolutely. And another American one from Josh909, Andrew Jackson's inauguration. 20,000 people trashed the White House and ate a lot of cheese, and apparently the White House smelt of cheese for months. So anyway, they didn't make the cut.
Nor Dominic did a joke that about 400 people made.
I thought this was quite funny.
Of which Jack Clark is representative. Change UK.
Yes.
So do you want, again, for our overseas listeners, just explain that joke. I mean, this is like kind of explaining a Shakespeare comedy or something.
A very ill-fated centrist political party formed an opposition, I think largely to Brexit, but also to Jeremy Corbyn. It didn't do very well, but there's also that party of Gina Miller's, the Truth and Fairness Party, or Truen. I can't remember what it's called, but only six people turned up to the launch of it.
But not that kind of party, of course.
No, so, no. They're not as disastrous as our 10th choice.
Well, should we just say, so we've, you and me yesterday, we went through and we kind of winnowed them down. And we're going to do it like the kind of Top of the Pops. We're going to go from 10 up to 1. So we find out what we voted the most disastrous party of all time.
Yeah.
So I hope you will find the tension kind of mounting as we go through. So, but number 10, what comes in at number 10, Dominic?
So it's a hunting party in the Black Forest, Tom. They are at Donaueschingen Castle in Donaueschingen, Baden-Württemberg. Their date is the 14th of November, 1908. Very much a friend of the show, the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, notorious for his ill-chosen shoes.
Yes.
Tom Holland-style shoes.
And this is very much a party that revolves around ill-chosen dress, isn't it?
It is. Well.
Well. We don't know what the Kaiser was wearing, but we do know what his old childhood friend,
yes,
Count Dietrich von Hülsen-Heißeler, was wearing.
We do.
I've got a printout of him, and he's a very, I think fair to say, a Prussian-looking gentleman.
He's very German. I mean, he's got the whole moustache. Yeah. He's very stolid. He's a man who's been eating sausage for for decades.
His jacket is festooned with medals and iron crosses, shaven-headed, square-headed. And this reminds me that this was nominated by a friend of the show, Dan Jackson, who does love a Teutonic gentleman in military uniform, I've noticed from his Twitter feed. So this guy was a Prussian. He was the son of a general. He became a general. He was a childhood friend of the Kaiser. And in 1889, he became the aide-de-camp to the Kaiser. Or should that be the aide-de-camp?
Yes, very good. I believe he's the chief of the German Imperial Military Cabinet at this point, Tom.
So very important figure.
And they're at Prince Max von Fürstenberg's castle, as we've said, in Baden-Württemberg.
And they've been hunting, haven't they?
So they've been hunting. They've had great laughs together hunting. The Kaiser's a great huntsman. They come back and they have formal evening a kind of dinner and so on. And Count von Hülsen-Heißeler clearly must leave the room at some point and then
I think it's fair to say he misreads the mood.
Well, you don't know. I mean, maybe this is... He comes in and he's dressed...
He's dressed in a pink tutu and ballet tights and a kind of pink leotard. He does a kind of Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy with pirouettes and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then he keels over of a heart attack.
Supposedly he does a lot of capers and jumps.
He's an implausible ballerina, it's fair to say. Anyway, so he has a heart attack, and that's very sad for him.
He does this routine, and then he dies. And they call a doctor. Did you see this? They call a doctor. Well, by the time the doctor's got there, they've failed to resuscitate him, and they pronounce him dead. He's succumbed to rigor mortis. They struggle to get him out of his tutu. Because he's obviously a really hefty, he's a really hefty bloke. So they...
They don't bury him in it.
No, they don't. But the weird thing about this, Tom, and I said that parties, when I was not laughing, I said that parties were disastrous when they accentuated existing anxiety. The Kaiser and the German High Command, they have been racked for the last 2 years by accusations of homosexuality.
Yes, the Eulenburg scandal.
Yes, exactly. And an imperialist journalist, Maximilian Harden, he's accused the Prince Philip of Eulenburg of being gay, of being part of a sort of gay ring. Some officers have committed suicide after being blackmailed. There have been a series of libel cases. And actually, the Kaiser has asked Count von Hülsen-Heißeler to kind of clean up the Prussian high command. So the weird thing is...
Why is he doing it?
Has he cracked under the strain and put on the tutu? Or is this a sort of elaborate in-joke? Is he maybe...
I don't know.
Having a laugh in private about this sort of situation they find themselves. Anyway, he's been in his tutu. He's dropped dead. It's very embarrassing.
Okay, so that's not a good party. So that's
well,
it. Number it can't, 10.
I think we can say it cast a pall over the evening.
And over the Kaiser's reputation and the reputation of the German high command.
Yeah, I think that's
for quite a
right.
way. Yeah. And it has been argued that the Kaiser was left with a determination to prove his manliness that resulted in the First World War. So
that's absolutely right. There's a lot of literature on pre-First World War origins about manliness and gender and this sort of stuff and about these sort of anxieties. Anyway, we need to go down this rabbit hole too deeply, but this is our number 10.
Okay, and at number 9, nominated by Brian Spabler, we have the Fyre Festival, F-Y-R-E. And Dominic, you must love this one. Playing to all your darkest expectations of millennials.
It is. It's terrible behaviour, isn't it? So the Fyre Festival, for those people who don't know, it's been the subject of two rival documentaries, one on Netflix, one by Hulu. It was founded by Wikipedia claims a con artist, I don't know whether that's too harsh, called Billy McFarland, and a rapper called Ja Rule. I'm not sure how you say it. So basically, they want to promote an app called the Fyre app, which is an app for booking bands. And they schedule this sort of 2-weekend festival in April and May 2017 on an island called Great Exuma in the Bahamas.
But originally, they'd been planning to have it on another island, hadn't they? That they'd kind of visited while they were on a private jet, and they'd landed on this island. And it had previously been owned by one of the leading henchmen of Pablo Escobar.
That's right. And the show Narcos was then very popular in the US.
So they were very excited by that.
And they were told, do not publicize this using Pablo Escobar's name, that one of his henchmen. But I've seen their ad. I looked up this ad preparing for this podcast. It's still there. It's a real sort of Instagrammer's kind of ad. And on the ad, it says explicitly, on an island owned by Pablo Escobar, which is just untrue. Pablo Escobar did not own this island.
But that's why they then have that's the problem, because the people who own it are furious and kick them off. So they then have to go and find some other place, and they go to Great Exuma, and that's fine, they book in. But the problem is that the Exuma Regatta is going on
that's
at
right.
the same
so all
time.
The hotels
so everyone has booked up all the hotels.
That's right, yeah.
And they've kind of promised incredible luxury. They've got loads of kind of Instagram stars.
Are you familiar with all these people, Tom? Kendall Jenner? Are you familiar with the work of Kendall Jenner?
Daughter of the Jenners.
Related to Greg Jenner, the podcaster.
Yes.
Bella Hadid, are you well follow her work?
Big fan.
Hayley Baldwin, Emily Ratajkowski. I see that name in Mail Online all the time, but I don't know who it is.
Anyway, they were all paid to advertise it, and then there was a scandal over that. But basically,
did you see the list of acts? Are you familiar with the acts?
No.
Are you not familiar with the work of Pusha T, Designer with Two Eyes?
No.
Skepta, Claptone. What about Lee Burridge?
Are you?
Well, Lee Burridge sounds like he plays in goal for Northampton Town, I think, compared with the others.
Lee Burridge, that's the worst name.
It is, it's not a great good name. Anyway, they didn't turn up, all these bands. I mean, some of them hadn't even been booked. It was all a complete con. The best part of this con, actually, was that they told, the organisers told people who bought tickets, it will be cashless and cardless. Right. So basically, you have to give us lots of money now, and we'll send you a bracelet with your money on it. And this was a sort of wireless, it would work by Wi-Fi. But when the people got to the islands, there's no wireless on the islands. So
and there's nowhere to stay.
No, they all stayed
in. They kind of got tents, but there weren't enough tents to go round.
United Nations tents, Tom. Refugee tents. And they gave them cheese sandwiches.
Yeah.
So the reason this is resonant, I think, is because it's 2017 and it seemed to, I mean, there was enormous quantities of schadenfreude because a lot of the people who paid up, 5,000 people had to be sort of flown out, had to be like refugees. And I think this thing about parties or scandals throwing things into relief, it was seen as the sort of, the self-delusion of the Instagram generation.
Right.
It?
So it's all about Instagram because the whole thing was designed to look good on Instagram. So that was why it was Instagram influencers advertising it. And so the fact that it then turned out to be, you were camped out in a cesspool with a cheese sandwich. Was everybody who hadn't gone
well?
Everybody adored it.
Basically, everybody over the age of 35 thought it was just absolutely the best thing that.
But
ever
I
happened.
Think also all the people who would have loved to go, also enjoyed it because they hadn't and they dodged a bullet.
Well, this is true. Do you not feel like that? When I mean, I'm not a natural festival goer. I don't think that'll surprise any of the audience to hear that. That whenever I, when I was in my 20s and I used to see news footage of a deluge at Glastonbury and people, trudging miserably through torrents of mud, I always used to think. I'm so happy they're there and I'm here.
But I think there's a difference because you expect that at Glastonbury, and that's kind of factored in as part of the fun.
That's true.
And,
that's
and
true.
Actually, you know, there's nothing, you know, Kate Moss in a pair of boots wandering around. That's absolutely what is going to look good on Instagram. But the thing about this was that essentially, you pay an enormous amount of money to look like, you know, a refugee, basically.
Yeah. And it was the contrast of what was sold and then what was
Ja tweeted. Rule tweeted, "It was not a scam. This is not my fault." And the official statement said, "Due to circumstances out of our control, the physical infrastructure was not in place on time, and we are unable to fulfill on our vision safely and enjoyably for our guests."
Well, the main guy was sent to prison.
Six years.
Yeah.
So
so the lesson for that, don't go to a festival unless it's a history festival. Let's move on to number eight.
Number eight.
A man who actually I can kind of see at the Fyre Festival, the young Peter the Great.
The young Peter the Great. And this was suggested by Simon Girdleston. And I'm just going to read it out because really there's very little to add to it. So Simon, I nominate Peter the Great's stay at John Evelyn's house, Sales Court in Deptford in 1698, in which Peter and his entourage of 70 soldiers, four dwarfs, a cook, a priest and a monkey consumed a colossal volume of spirits, burned all the furniture for firewood, including all 50 chairs, used all the 25 fine pictures for target practice, smashed all the doors and locks, left the carpets and floors covered in such a layer of grease that all were ruined and three floors had to be ripped up entirely, broke 300 window panes and smashed all the hedges in the garden that it had taken Evelyn 20 years to grow, as well as all the wheelbarrows by using them in drunken races.
That's pretty much it. So Peter the Great is on his grand tour of the West. He's come to London. He wants to look at the shipyards, but everything is, it's in the winter of 1698.
Well, he goes to Amsterdam first, doesn't he?
He does, exactly.
And this is when William III is king of England and he's whatever.
Yeah.
Stadtholder, is he? Prince?
Prince of Orange.
Prince of Orange in the Netherlands.
So he then comes to London. The Thames is frozen. Everything is frozen. People are skating and selling pies on the ice. And basically because crowds keep coming to look at Peter the Great, he goes off.
Well, he's incredibly tall, isn't he? And he's in disguise, so everyone's pretending it's not really him. But he's so tall.
Him. And John Evelyn, the diarist, very famous 17th century diarist, he's been looking after this garden for 45 years, laying out the hedges, which are his pride and joy.
And he sublet it.
He to Peter the Great.
So, no, he hasn't sublet it.
He sublet it
to somebody else.
Admiral Benbow, who then sublets it to Peter the Great.
So they never actually meet.
No, and at one point, actually, Evelyn's steward writes to Evelyn. He says, "The house is full of people and right nasty." And this is exactly what happened. So he actually gets Christopher Wren and the royal gardener to go to the house to examine the state and to
assess the damage.
And to assess the damage. Yeah, and it's exactly as you say. The tiles have all been smashed. The windows have all been broken. There are 50 chairs in the house, and every one of them has been smashed. The pictures have all been used for target practice, and it's their garden, I think, that's the big issue. Because this hedge has been utterly destroyed by people ramming wheelbarrows into it.
And having races.
And now apparently what they used to do was they would put the Tsar in the wheelbarrow and race him into the hedges.
Well, anyone who's seen The Great, about Catherine the Great and her marriage to Peter III, will recognise this.
The analogy here is sort of parents going away for the weekend and their children advertise a party on Facebook. And a load of Russians turn up and
wheelbarrow racing.
Apologies to any Russian listeners. I'm sure there are plenty of Russian listeners who are much better behaved than Peter the Great was. But anyway, £350 and ninepence was the damage. And that, you know, I haven't done the conversion, but that's a colossal amount of money.
Yeah.
In 17th century terms.
So those are three in which nobody died.
Yeah.
But it's not really a disastrous party unless there's a kind of brutal killing.
Well, hold on. No. That bloke died before, the tutu man.
Of course he did. Yes, he did. Yes, apologies. Yes, he did. But he wasn't murdered.
No, nobody's murdered anybody yet, which is disappointing.
So now we come to our first party that involved a murder. In fact, quite a few murders. And this is the brilliantly named Blood Feast of Roskilde.
Anders Newgard has suggested this.
Who I'm imagining is perhaps a Danish listener.
I should think so, yeah. So in 12th century Denmark, aren't we?
Yeah, 9th of August, 1157. But the roots of this, Dominic, lie in events that we covered in our 1066 episode. So it involves Svein II, who was the king of Denmark, who sent the very last kind of what could be called a Viking expedition.
Yeah.
In, I think, 1067. 1069, that's right. against England, and he'd been the great rival of Harold Hardrada, who we've talked about quite a lot.
Yeah.
But the other thing he does is he has enormous quantities of children,
and they all fall out with each other.
So it's like Edward III,
very much.
You know, with a kind of delayed aftershock with the Wars of the Roses. This is the Danish equivalent.
So there are three rival claimants, aren't there? By the point of this blood feast, is that right?
Well, again, the echo of Wars of the Roses in England. So in 1146, Eric III of Denmark abdicates and retires to a monastery. So he's that kind of guy.
Do you know what his sobriquet is?
Eric the Wet.
I think he's Eric the Memorable, isn't he?
Is he?
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, the fact that he can't, clearly isn't that memorable.
Well, I suppose memorable for a disastrous decision.
Well, go on.
Because he abdicates, and there are three alternative candidates.
Yeah.
And apparently, in kind of Danish lists of kings, they're all remembered as kings.
They all overlap, exactly. They
so you've
all
got Svein the Second.
No, Svein the Third. Svein the Third.
Yes, of course, Svein the Third. Knut the Fifth. Voldemar the First.
Yeah.
And basically, these three kings all fight each other for 11 years, and then they hold council in Lolland, and it's a bit like King Lear. They decide to divide the kingdom into three, and they confirm the treaty by an oath. And then Svein invites the other two kings to a party in Roskilde.
Absolute idiots. I've been to Roskilde, Tom.
Yeah, it's great.
Fantastic ship museum. Yeah, ship museum. Yeah. I heartily recommend it.
A great cathedral.
Very nice. Red brick kind of cathedral, isn't it?
This is all a trap. Knut gets killed. Voldemar gets wounded in the thigh, but runs away, manages to escape.
Yeah.
And a few months later, he comes back with a big army. He defeats Svein, and he then becomes Voldemar the Great.
Yeah, so there's a man called, it's that classic thing. Svein has invited them to the party, and then Svein says, I just have to pop out for a second. Basically, if somebody you've been feuding with does that to you in medieval Europe, you're absolutely mad to say, oh yeah, well, I'll hang around here with your soldiers till, which is exactly what happens. He has a man called Detlef who just starts stabbing everybody. But the folly is not to kill Valdemar as well, because Valdemar escapes, doesn't he? He then fights Svein at a battle, the Battle of Grata Heide. Svein runs away. He's killed by a mob of angry peasants. And Valdemar becomes king of Denmark, exactly as you say. So basically, don't go to a party with a Danish king, I think.
And Valdemar becomes he's a very successful king, and he smites the Wends, who were pagans, who never did anything without consulting a talking horse.
Wow. That's a bit like Ptolemy the First and his talking snakes.
Yeah.
Talking animals are very much a feature of this podcast.
Yeah. So number six. Yeah, what have we got at six, Tom?
So number six, specifically, we're heading to Egypt, and we are heading to Cairo in the spring of 1811. An Albanian kind of warlord called Muhammad Ali, not the boxer, is sick of the Mamluks. The Mamluks are the Turkic kind of warrior class that have been running Egypt.
Who are Napoleon in Egypt.
Exactly. So this is the sequel, really, to Napoleon in Egypt, our earlier podcast. Egypt has reverted to sort of nominal Ottoman rule. Muhammad Ali wants to basically take it over for himself. He's sick of the Mamluks. And in that classic way that is so common, it's going to be so common in this podcast, the way to do it is to invite them all to a party. Now, there's a lot of them. There's hundreds of them. They are this sort of warrior elite from whose ranks for centuries the masters of Egypt have basically been chosen or emerged through sort of bloody competition. And Tom, do you want to tell the story of what happens to the Mamluks?
Well, it's his son's birthday party, which is the kind of exquisite twist. And he holds this in the citadel. Anyone who's been to Cairo, it's kind of brilliant. Everything that you'd expect the citadel of Cairo to be. And it has a very steep, narrow passage that connects the kind of upper reaches of the fort to the lower gate. So they go there and they enjoy the party. They enjoy the party cake and the games and pass the parcel.
There's
and
a lot
all
of
that
sweet
kind of
meats,
stuff.
Which is exactly what I expect from an Egyptian party.
Of course. And then they all start filing down this steep, narrow passage. And the Albanians slam the doors shut. The Mamluks are going down on their horses. And they're trapped in this passageway. And so they're easy game, and they all get wiped out. Or do they? The story goes that one of them jumps over the wall.
On his horse?
On his horse. And the horse dies, but he manages to get away. And he's the only survivor.
Yeah.
But that's the story. So that's not a good party. And I think it's fair to say that dynastic change in Islamic history often features terrible parties. So the very first one the Umayyads are the first Islamic dynasty.
Yeah.
And they get eliminated by the Abbasids, who go on to found Baghdad. And the last Umayyad caliph, Marwan, gets pursued to Egypt, gets cornered, killed, head gets sent to the Abbasids, and they feed his tongue to a cat. But they're anxious to round up the remaining Umayyads.
Yeah.
And so they get them all and they stab them, and then they use them as a kind of the foundation for a party. So they drape them with carpets and put all the kind of, you know, the couches and
the treats,
the sweetmeats and things. Yeah. And that they all lie there and they can hear the groans of the Umayyads as they slowly expire. So I suppose that's a great party if you're an Abbasid, but it's a terrible party if you're an Umayyad.
See, Tom, I was actually, when we were drafting this, I was a bit gutted that we chose that and not Chappaquiddick. But now I think that is a better party, a more disastrous party than Chappaquiddick.
Yes, I think it probably is.
We have to come back to Chappaquiddick in a future Ted Kennedy's rather darkest hour. Well, not just his darkest hour, but Mary Jo Pinkney's darkest hour in a future podcast, I think.
Yes, we will, definitely. Right, so we're halfway through the top 10. Tension is mounting. I think at this point we should take a break. And when we come back, we'll be giving the top 5.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. Now, before we continue with history's most disastrous parties, we want to let you know that we are going to let you, the listeners, choose the topic of an upcoming episode. What could possibly go wrong? So we've had billions of episode suggestions on Twitter and on email and on our Discord chat room for the Rest is History club members over the last few months. And we have narrowed them down to the big four options, and we want you, the listeners, to decide. So, Tom, would you like to unveil the shortlist?
Number one, the historical Jesus, suggested by Joe Evans Green. Number two, the Winter of Discontent and the late 70s by Roy Nelly. Number three, top sidekicks. So that's Agrippa, Eden, Keith Joseph, and that's suggested by Simon Girdleston. And number four, the special relationship. So I guess that's Britain and America, and that's suggested by Amy Mantravardi.
So there you have it. The historical Jesus, the Winter of Discontent, top sidekicks, and the special relationship. And if you want to get involved, it is a bit like choosing a party leader. It is one person, one vote. We don't have a trade union block vote in The Rest is History. But you do have to be a member of The Rest is History club, whether you call yourself a Wang, a friend of the show, or an Athelstan. Doesn't matter, but you have to be part of the club to vote. So go to restishistorypod.com, you sign up to the Discord, and then you click on the polls channel to cast your vote. The poll is now live, and it will be until Wednesday evening, and we will announce the winning topic on next week's episode, and we will then think about when we're going to record it. So, welcome back to The Rest is History. We're all about parties this week. We've done some of the top 10 most disastrous parties in history. We are approaching our top 5. Tom, a great character awaits us now. One of my favorite Roman emperors, Elagabalus.
Yes.
Sun-worshipping, by all accounts, a dreadful man, though some perhaps much maligned by the... I'm basing this on the Augustan history, yeah, which I suspect you'll tell me is pure propaganda. So what century are we in, first
we
of all?
We're in the early 3rd century. So the age of the Antonine Peace is... coming to an end. In fact, Elagabalus is the last of the Antonine in that particular family. He reigns 218 to 222. And as you say, the main source for his life is the Augustan history. And it's the account that it gives is very, very lurid.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly.
So Elagabalus is, according to this biography of him in the Augustan history, very much a party animal. So he likes to dress up as Venus. He's reputedly the first emperor to wear nothing but silk.
That's right, yeah.
He lolls around on cushions that are filled with rabbit fur. Couches made entirely of silver. He feeds his dogs on foie gras. He only swims in perfumed swimming pools. He has a chariot drawn by kind of female ponies, so women who, you know, bitted and bridled and human ponies. But he's a japester.
Well, some of these details are absolutely preposterous. So some of his, I'm just reading from the Augustan history. Some of his humbler friends he would seat on air pillows instead of on cushions, and he would let out the air while they were dining, so that often the diners were suddenly found under the table. Yeah. I mean, that's only a step up from a whoopee cushion.
But if you get that, you get off lightly.
Another
gag of his was to invite people to massive banquets, but the food that they were given was made entirely out of wax or wood or pottery or whatever, where he'd have real food and he'd be guzzling away. They just have to content themselves, you know, they just have to stare at it and then pretend that they'd eaten. But the worst was if he invited you to stay overnight.
Oh, yeah. And he'd get you hammered.
And then he'd say, I've procured you the most skillful and beautiful courtesans in the world, and leave the lights off. And they'd wake up and discover that there were withered old crones.
Yeah, old hags from Ethiopia. Yes. It says in the August. But I thought you were going to say what he does is, it says here, when his friends became drunk, he would shut them up. And suddenly during the night, he would let in his lions and leopards and bears.
So that's the ultimate.
So that all of them harmless, because they'd obviously had their teeth taken out or something. So that his friends on awakening at dawn, or worse during the night, would find leopards and bears in the room. And some even died, basically of a heart attack, when they woke up to find they were sleeping next to a leopard.
Yeah, so he's a tremendous laugh.
One more though, Tom, one more. This is the most banal, I think. He would propose to his guests by way of a feat they should invent new sauces for giving flavour to the food. And he would offer a large prize for the man who invented the best sauce. On the other hand, if the sauce did not please him, the inventor was ordered to continue eating it until he invented a better one. So imagine turning up with a sauce, you've got to keep eating it until you come up with a better one.
Well, it's kind of MasterChef with...
Yeah, with leopards.
With leopards.
Yeah.
I think that'd be brilliant.
You know who'd have enjoyed his parties, Tom? Dietrich Graf von Hülsenhäusler.
Yes, he would.
And Ted Kennedy, actually. He'd have loved it as well.
Well, actually, a comment on this from Joseph Evans Green. This episode will surely be awash with absolute lads. I mean, I think basically all these guys, I mean, imagine. Anyway, the famous party that Elagabalus supposedly hosted is illustrated by the famous painting by Laurens Alma Tadema, the kind of Dutch painter of classical scenes. And it shows Elagabalus drowning his guests beneath, suffocating his guests beneath rose petals. And the story goes that rose petals start to drop down on the guests when they're at their table, and everyone's thinking, oh, this is delightful, how charming. And they continue to fall, and they continue to fall, and they continue to fall until everyone is dead. Suffocated by it. And when Alma Tadema painted this very famous painting, if you haven't seen it, do Google it. It was in the dead of winter, and so we had to send for rose petals from the French Riviera, which is kind of great.
That's very Elagabalan behavior in itself.
Well, it is. And Elagabalus was the great hero of the kind of, you know, the decadence and romantics, so kind of wild and people like that.
Aubrey Beardsley-ish kind of people.
Aubrey Beardsley, yeah. Antonin Artaud called him the crowned anarchist.
What happened to him, Tom? Nothing good.
He got murdered. He got murdered.
Of course he did. Because he can't make people sit on air cushions and next to leopards for that long.
One party too far.
Yeah.
So he's at number five, and I think he's not higher because it probably didn't happen.
Yes, that's the issue with this, isn't it? That none of it really happened. So
So that's a shame. I think you know, parties actually have to have happened.
But our next party definitely did happen because we mentioned it on the show before. Number four. That's right, isn't it, Tom?
It is, yeah.
So this is suggested by James Lavender. And we then have an honourable mention. Well, so it's the Black Dinner. It's the first Scottish party of the top 10. And we also, because this is really a sort of a devolved administrations party section, because we're also going to be touching on the Abergavenny Massacre recommended by Andrew Patterson. So, Tom, tell us about the Black Dinner.
So the Black Dinner... lots of fans of Game of Thrones will have heard of this because it provided the model for the Red Wedding. And it's called the Black Dinner both because it was a terrible thing, but also because it involves the Douglases, who are probably the most powerful of the lowland families in the late Middle Ages. They had come to prominence during the Scottish Wars of Independence. And you have Sir James Douglas, who was known to the Scots as the good Douglas, and to the English as Black Douglas, because he was such a kind of proficient fighter against them. And He is the guy who gets charged by Robert Bruce to take his heart to the Holy Land, and he takes a wrong turning and ends up in Spain, where he dies fighting the Moors.
Oh, that's very unfortunate.
Bruce's heart is brought back and buried, I think, in, is it Melrose? I think it's buried.
It might be Melrose, yeah.
The Earl of Douglas is known as Black Douglas. The Earl of Angus, who's another kind of family, and this, again, going back to Macbeth, the complexities of Scottish families are known as the Red Douglases. And the Black Dinner takes place in 1440, so that's several generations after the original Douglas. And it's not an uncle murdering his nephew, but it's a great uncle.
Yeah, murdering the 16-year-old William Douglas, isn't it?
Yeah, who is the sixth Earl of Douglas, and his younger brother. So it's quite Richard III.
But this is also a children's party, which is worse, because they're invited to dinner with James II of Scotland,
who's 10 years old.
10 years old, yeah. And while they're eating, they're having a lovely dinner. James II is having a wonderful time. And while they're eating, the servants bring in a black bull's head, which is meant to be...
They couldn't get a magician.
Yeah. It's basically, when they bring in this black bull's head, it's a symbol of death. This is the equivalent of the black spot from Treasure Island, isn't it? At that point, these two... So William Douglas is 16. He's turned up with his younger brother. At this point, when the black bull's head makes its appearance, they're dragged out, aren't they? And basically beheaded. Is that right,
yeah.
Tom?
Yeah. After a kind of fake trial.
And they're beheaded so that they're, one of the people who's organised it is also a Douglas, so that he can basically get the wealth and titles and the earldom.
Well, that's the great uncle.
Right.
So James, yeah.
It's very bad form. Walter Scott writes a poem about this. Tom, do you want to know how it goes?
Yeah, I'd love to. Love a bit of poetry.
Edinburgh Castle, town and tower, God grant thou sink for sin, and that e'en for the black dinner, all Douglas gat therein. Who knows what that means? I don't know what that means, but anyways, that was a very... The Scotsman would give that more than one star, I think.
A wonderful flavour of what the world missed when you were denied the chance to play Macbeth.
Or indeed Walter Scott. Well, now, talking of great dramatic portrayals, so the Abergavenny Massacre, are you familiar with this?
No, but I saw it being suggested by Andrew Patterson.
So the Abergavenny Massacre is not dissimilar from this or from the Roskilde carry-on. We're on the Welsh marches. William de Breos, who's a sort of marcher lord, he invites a man called Sitsalt and all the prowess chieftains to a feast at Christmas. They're going to, you know, bury all the hatchets and be great pals and have a wonderful time. It's the classic Game of Thrones style story. They pitch up Christmas feast, stack the weapons in a corner, ale is flowing. Suddenly the doors are barred. William de Breuse's men rush in and massacre everybody. William de Breuse earns the name, the Ogre of Abergavenny. And Abergavenny Castle has this taint of treachery and murder ever since. So this is...
And are the people he's murdering Welsh?
They're Welsh. They are Welsh.
So this is a kind of... Well, he's not English, is he? Because he's
no, he's Norman, a Norman kind of martial. But here's the weird thing. So this fellow, whoever it was, suggested Abergavenny Massacre. Who was it who suggested it?
Andrew Patterson.
I thought I'll read up on this. I saw there was a big thing on the Brecon Beacons National Park official website about it, because obviously it's taking place there. I had a look, and there's an essay on the Brecon Beacons National Park website written apparently by William de Breos defending himself in the style of Donald Trump. Can you believe that? It's so weird. People who don't understand, they only believe liars and haters. People who fail to make up their own minds as to the truth, they call me the Ogre of Abergavenny. Wrong. I gathered a team, truly great and talented men, patriots, to plan very smoothly, very effectively, very efficiently how we could defeat these terrorists once and for all and make the marches safe for civilization and make the crown great again. My many enemies, losers, and jealous people have misrepresented this story. The news of the Christmas victory did not get the praise it deserved. We stayed strong. We won a great victory, a truly great victory. And it goes on like that for hours, basically, explaining why the massacre at Abergavenny, he's been hard done by losers and liars, the fake news media and all this stuff. It's such a weird thing to be on the official National Park website, but there it is.
Well, I like that.
So you didn't expect...
No, I didn't.
...that story to take that turn, but it did.
So disastrous parties can have, you know...
Hilarious consequences.
Hilarious consequences. Yeah.
Well, that brings us very neatly to...
to number three, which I think is a truly terrible party. I mean, it's an awful party, and it's been seared on my mind ever since I read Barbara Tuchman's Distant Mirror years and years ago, one of my favourite books when I was about 12.
Yes.
And this is the Bal des Ardents, Charles VI, the dance of the kind of burning people.
Yeah.
Dance of the people set on fire. And this is the story of Charles VI, who in a way is the kind of the Henry VI of France. So this is kind of the interval in the Hundred Years' War. So the English have come, they fought Cressy, they fought Poitiers. They've basically been kind of forced back out under that great French king, Charles V. Charles V has died in 1380, and he's succeeded by his son, Charles, originally named Charles, who becomes Charles VI, aged 12.
Yeah. Poor fellow, he's as mad as a hatter, Tom.
Well, he's not at this point. So in his kind of teenage years, he's not. He comes of age, he starts ruling. We have various dukes, among them our old friend, the Duke of Burgundy, well, Philip the Bold.
Yeah, people who listen to our Burgundy podcast may remember Charles VI and what he later believes about himself.
All these, so there are all these kind of various predatory dukes and so on hanging around. And in 1392, Charles VI becomes obsessed with the idea that one of these kind of powerful magnates is out to get him. And he's retreated to Brittany. And so Charles orders an invasion force to go out from Paris to invade Brittany. And he's riding along and he is apart from the rest of the group because it's very hot, it's very dusty. He doesn't want to get the dust that's been kicked up by all his partner's horses in his nose. And he's riding along and suddenly a barefoot madman comes running out of the woods and reaches up and tries to hold his bridle. And he shouts out, "Ride no further, noble king, turn back, you are betrayed." And he follows the king shouting this for about half an hour. And it's obviously very, very uncomfortable, very unsettling for the king, who's starting to feel a bit dizzy in the heat. And they stop. And then one of his pages drops a lance and it clangs against the helmet. And suddenly the king goes completely mad and he draws his sword and he's convinced that he's being attacked by people. He starts attacking his own party. He attacks his brother, yeah, the Duke of Orléans, Louis, the Duke of Orléans, and he has to be kind of overpowered. And Philip, Duke of Burgundy, seizes control of the situation. They head back to Paris and the king is nursed back to a precarious kind of health by winter. And over the winter season, everyone decides that the way to get the king, you know, happy, to get him functioning, is to provide a whole series of parties.
It's like tomfoolery, just endless tomfoolery, isn't it?
Japes, yeah. Mad capery. And on the 28th of January, his wife, Isabeau, the queen, she is celebrating the third wedding of one of her favorite ladies-in-waiting. And it's the custom when you celebrate the wedding of someone who's already been married that you kind of have particularly riotous behavior.
Yeah, you do it in a less, dare I say, a less sacral way, Tom.
A less sacral way, yes. So decorum is thrown to the winds. It's like Downing Street. and there's a very unpleasant guy called Huguet de Guise, who is very, very unpleasant. And his particular party trick is if a servant offends him, he kind of forces the servant to fall down on the floor, and he puts his spurred boot on the back of the servant and he shouts out, "Bark, dog, bark."
Oh,
it's a bit like Succession.
Yeah.
The boar on the floor. If there is seen Succession. That episode. And Ugo decides that it would be tremendous fun and obviously brilliant when the king is a little bit precarious and fragile, if they all dress up as trees, as kind of wild men of the trees. So they coat themselves in pitch. And they add various branches, bits of wood, bits of twig.
And sort of hair and fur and stuff, yes. Isn't it? Really kind of
And they
weird.
All wear masks so that nobody can see who they are. And because obviously they understand that this is a fire hazard. I mean, that's part of the thrill of it. You know, that you're dicing with death. Very strict orders are given that no one is to have a torch.
That's right.
So there are six of them. They all go rushing in to where the queen and her lady-in-waiting are celebrating the nuptials. And they start dancing.
And shouting obscenities.
Shouting obscenities. Nobody knows who they are.
Yeah.
But, you know, but this is what people have been expecting. And then disastrously, Louis, the king's brother,
yeah,
the Duke of Orléans, comes in and he hasn't heard the
orders. He's a bit tipsy and he's carrying a torch.
Carries a torch. And a spark catches the pitch on the bodies of one of the revelers, and it just goes whoosh. And the queen screams because she knows that her husband is one of these six dancing men.
But his aunt, who is only 15, is wearing a massive dress, colossal dress.
Duchesse de Berry.
And she throws her skirt over him to basically put out his, you know, to protect him from the flames and to put out any sparks that have attached themselves to him. But then the other five all... They basically go up like candles, don't they?
One of them jumps into a wine cooler.
He does, of course. Yes,
so
he does.
So two of them survive.
The Sieur de Nantouillet, he jumps into a big vat of, sort of Duke of Clarence style, jumps into a vat of wine. But the others...
So he's all right. The others. So one dies on the spot.
Yeah.
Two linger kind of for 2 days and then die of their burns. And then Huguet, the Guise, he dies after 3 days and he gets put in his coffin and the cortege go through Paris. And as it goes through the streets of Paris, everyone shouts out, bark, dog, bark.
Oh, my word. Well.
And of course, this drives the king completely round the twist.
I was about to say, this isn't good for Charles's mental health.
No, it's not good for his mental health. Sometimes he wakes up in the middle of the night.
Oh,
wondering,
Tom, if only he'd listened to your ads.
I know. wondering, will I ever stop being mad?
Yeah.
And he won't because he thinks he's made of glass and all that kind of stuff.
That's a very sad story, poor Charles.
But it's good for Henry V.
Yeah. So it all ends happily in the end.
Yes. Right. So that's, I think that's, I mean, in a way, the most upsetting, perhaps.
That's quite tragic. Well, this next party is very tragic. So number two, Claire J suggested this. I'm glad she did because it was one of the first parties I thought of when we talked about disastrous parties. So sort of friends of the show, or sort of tragic friends of the show, I should say, Nicholas and Alexandra, the last Tsar and Tsarina of Russia. They are getting crowned in May 1896 at the Uspensky Cathedral in the Kremlin. And there are all kinds of massive celebrations and festivities arranged to celebrate the latest kind of Romanov Tsar. And there's going to be a huge party, sort of festival banquet at Kadinka Field, based on the outskirts of Moscow. So the way that's going to work is they put up a sort of mock theatres, kind of wooden theatres. They've put up all kinds of stands. They've built 20 bars. Now, near where this sort of, where it's going to happen, there's this field with kind of all gullies and ravines, and it's kind of raggedy field. But that's fine. Everyone's going to turn up and have a tremendous time. Now, they are told by the evening of the 29th of May, so it's going to be the next day. On the 29th of May, the rumour goes around Moscow that there are going to be all kinds of gifts given to the people when this party takes place. So basically the gifts you get, now these may not sound like much to you, Tom, but people in Moscow in 1896, a bread roll, a piece of sausage, some pretzels, some gingerbread, and a commemorative cup.
Well, it sounds better than the Fire Festival.
Yeah, it's a lot better than the Fire Festival. So people are very excited about this. And the rumor goes around that in the cup, there will be a gold coin, which people are very, very excited by. So by dawn on the morning of the party, there are thousands of people already streaming onto this field. And basically, it's the classic thing. The authorities haven't anticipated the demand. They provided about 2,000 policemen, but that's nowhere near enough to control the crowds. And then a rumor goes around, sort of as the excitement mounts, the morning wears on, a rumor goes around that they are going to run out of pretzels and beer. And the crowd all get very excited and they stampede towards the stalls. And as I said, the field is kind of ragged and pitted and there's ditches and stuff. People start to fall into a ditch, more people pile on top of them. And basically, at least 1,200 people are crushed to death at this party. And there are thousands upon thousands more, perhaps as many as 20,000 who are badly injured. So it's an absolutely appalling, ghastly scene. The extraordinary thing is the festival continues. So the Tsar and Alexandra, they turn up at about 2 o'clock, by which time the dead have been taken away. And then that evening, they go on to a ball at the
French ambassador, isn't it?
The French embassy, exactly. Now, Nicholas writes about this in his diary, and he says, you know, it's a terrible mishap and awful, awful and all this. But because he and Alexandra are very controlled, slightly neurotic, anxious, serious people, they don't do a kind of Princess Diana and go and emote. And
no, they go to church.
They exactly, or, and everybody
moral
says
or whatever it is,
and everybody says, you know, they don't care, they don't. So right from the beginning, lots of people say, well, first of all, it
well, he gets
it,
called Bloody Nicholas.
Bloody Nicholas, exactly.
So this is, he has this nickname right from the beginning.
It's ill-fated that this is a terrible omen for his reign. But of course, the reason it, one of the reasons it's a terrible omen is that in a very unequal, divided, febrile society, it's the worst possible start. And it, you know, no scriptwriter could imagine a scene better calculated to prove that you have an uncaring, aloof elite and a downtrodden, oppressed majority.
And as you've said all along, the key to a really disastrous party is that it holds a mirror up to fractures and
exactly
pathologies within a society, which obviously this does very powerfully. Right. So that, I think that's indisputably a terrible party. We now come to our choice of number one.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of a cheat this because we have actually already discussed it.
Well, it's two parties in one list this though.
So so that's why we've chosen it, because this is a disastrous party that echoes down the centuries.
It's
gives birth to a second disastrous party. So we have chosen as our most disastrous party in history, Alexander burning down Persepolis. Alexander the Great.
Well, it's basically Persepolis as a party venue, I think this isn't it.
Yeah.
So tell us about Alexander, Tom.
Well, we've got Simon James George. Not many parties get that out of hand.
Yeah.
So Alexander, so Joseph Evans Green had said that this episode will be awash with absolute lads. Alexander is obviously the ultimate lad. And he features in three disastrous parties, really. So there's the party that is held to celebrate his father, Philip. He gets remarried, gets drunk, stumbles. And Alexander, who's very miffed that his father has remarried, kind of dismissively, you know, this is when Philip is planning to invade Persia, says, "Men of Macedon, what a fine hero the states of Greece have to lead their armies from Europe to Asia. He's not able to pass from one table to another without falling." Philip tries to kill him. Alexander runs away. It's all terrible.
But also, Tom,
it's a bad wedding party.
But also, Philip, they had a party, didn't they, for Philip's daughter, was it Alexander's sister who was getting married? And that's where Philip was assassinated.
That's another one.
Philip has a terrible record at parties.
Yeah. So that's a bad. So there's four. So that's a bad one. Then there's the murder of Black Clitus, friend of Philip, kind of mentor to Alexander,
the brother of Alexander's old nanny.
Yeah. So they have a massive bust up, and Alexander ends up skewering him with a spear.
That's in Samarkand, isn't it?
This one is 330. Alexander has he's defeated the Persians in three great battles. The third one at Gaugamela, Darius III has fled, so Mesopotamia and Persia are now Alexander's. So he goes to Babylon, and then he rides up to Persepolis, which is it's the city that most symbolizes the power of the Persian dynasty, the Achaemenids, whom Alexander has toppled. And although generally Alexander wants to lay claim to the inheritance of the Persian Empire, on this occasion, clearly he has decided that Persepolis should go, that he will be making a statement that the Achaemenid era is over and that he is the new king of Persia. And the story goes that he is celebrating capture of Persepolis, riotously drunk, and there is a courtesan there, Hetaira, called Thais, who is the mistress of Ptolemy, our friend with the talking snakes, who subsequently becomes king of Egypt. And she is Athenian. And one of the Persian kings, Xerxes, had burnt the Acropolis during the invasion of Greece in 480 BC. And she says, let's have vengeance. Let's burn Persepolis. And so the story goes that Alexander, very drunk by this point, and all the gang, Thais kind of cheering them on, incinerate the palace.
They throw all these torches, don't they, into the Xerxes, the hall with the thousand columns or whatever it's called. The fantastic, you know, the buildings that are far greater than anything in Greece. The finest, most splendid statements of power in the sort of Near Eastern world.
Well, often sculpted by Greeks.
But they're absolutely, you know, they're a lot of made of wood, so it all burns down. These rafters come crashing down. It's a terrible scene. But as you say, it resounds down the centuries because it becomes, that party becomes the sort of template, doesn't it? It's the ultimate symbol of hubris and sort of drunkenness and all this kind of stuff. And actually, that next Persepolis party has also become a symbol of hubris, though some historians think slightly unfairly. So let's go more than 2,000 years forward in time. We're in 19...
Kudos to Nathan Hogg.
For suggesting this. Yeah, very good suggestion. We're in 1971, in October 1971, and it is the 2,500th anniversary of Persia, of the sort of...
No, Persia, Cyrus.
Of Cyrus the Great, exactly. And the Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who we talked about in our oil crisis, oil weapon episode, he is very keen to assert Iranian power, modernity, sort of its renewed status in the world, to assert his regime and all this stuff. So he organizes this colossal party. It's as with so much of this, like with Elagabalus's party, how much of this is true is actually difficult to say, even though it's very recent, because the Guinness Book of Records crowned this the greatest banquet in human history. But whether that's really the truth is...
Well, the food is flown in from
Maxim's in Paris. Exactly, yeah. And there's all kinds of... There's 250 Mercedes limousines.
Yes, they all pick them up.
There's dinnerware from the Limoges. There are special plates commissioned from Spode of England. 10,000 plates decorated in turquoise and gold. All this sort of stuff is special.
And lots of the Queen doesn't go.
Duke of Edinburgh goes.
Nixon doesn't go.
Spiro Agnew goes.
Spiro Agnew, Princess Anne goes. Haile Selassie goes.
Yeah, Haile Selassie, Tito, Imelda Marcos, Ceausescu, Mobutu. A lot of people who've turned up in the show before. They all go. So it's an absolutely, tremendous occasion if you like dictators. And
all princesses.
And they have this huge blowout. And there's a Son and Lumiere show. There's all this kind of stuff. But what's so interesting is, so the Shah's regime falls. Sort of 7-8 years later in the Iranian Revolution. And the party becomes this metaphor for the hubris of the Shah's regime. It has done ever since. And the estimates of its cost have kind of ballooned and ballooned. Yeah. But it turns out, so I read there's an academic study of this by a chap called Robert Steele, and he says a lot of this stuff is just made up. So there's a claim, for example, they flew in 50,000 songbirds from Europe. And he says, this is just utterly invented. They didn't need to fly in songbirds. There are lots of songbirds in Iran. What happened is that when the revolution took place, in order to basically besmirch the Shah's, I mean, the party was an extravagant blowout, no question, but that people made ever more inflated claims about it in order to kind of paint the Shah as this sort of demented madman. And
but also it's to attack the very institution of monarchy itself.
Exactly.
Which is why the fact it's at Persepolis is so potent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, if you go to Persepolis... The frameworks of the tents that they put up, which I think were modelled on the
field of the cloth of gold.
Yeah. You can still see them. So you walk up a path towards the ruins, and the skeletons, the rusting skeletons of these tents are still there, I guess, as a
reminder. Yeah, exactly.
As a reminder. But I mean, all that stuff about the songbirds and everything, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it does suggest that, say, the Elagabalus episode, I mean, you can kind of... see how these stories develop, and indeed even the story that Alexander torches it as part of a drunken party. But I agree, it's really the ultimate disastrous party, I think, because it resonates so powerfully.
So Tom, give me your choice. So if there's one party, if you had to go to one, which would you go to, and which one would you least likely like to go to?
I think for the sheer improbability of it, seeing the ballet dance in the Black Forest.
That's what I'd choose.
I mean,
I enjoyed that story so much that I would love to have been at that party. Which would you least like to go to?
Well, I think the Rose Petals, because then you're going
to
die.
No. I'd have the one I'd least like to go to. Surely you must be able to get. I'd hate to go to the Fire Festival.
Yeah.
With a load of would-be influencers.
But the influencers didn't go. That's
I think if I went to that fest, if I'd gone to the Fire Festival, I mean, it's inconceivable. I can't imagine a scenario in which I would go to the Fire Festival. But if I had gone, I think I would much rather have been like the Black Dinner or a Mamluk. Or
is your dislike of going to festivals so great that you'd rather be smothered to death beneath rose petals?
If it was with the people at the Fire Festival, I think yes.
Well, if there are any influencers who are running massive festivals out there who'd like to invite Dominic.
I mean, it'd be a great endorsement for your festival, actually, if you converted me. So
yeah, it would.
I'm very much up for if like any of these Bella Hadid people want to contact me and invite me to their festival.
And maybe you could take your tutu.
Yeah, I'll go as Count Von whatever. How about that?
And we may have a new candidate for the most disastrous party of all time.
Exactly.
Anyway, thanks ever so much for listening. What have we got coming up, Dominic? We have got, we've got the last Emperor of Mexico, haven't
that's
we?
That's a very exciting story. Very
actually,
colorful
quite
story.
A few disastrous parties in that, I think.
So thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.